This edition of Meet the Writers was first broadcast on the 6th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin. My guest today is probably best known as an actor. He's featured in over 60 films, including With Nail and I, LA Story, Dracula, The Player, and Penelope, as well as numerous television shows. He's a perfumier on the brink of releasing his third fragrance, but the reason he's here today is that he's also a very accomplished diarist and author. He's written three books, By Design, a Hollywood novel, Wah Wah Diaries, The Making of a Film, and With Nails, the film diaries of Richard E. Grant. Richard, thanks so much for coming in to talk to me. This book was first published back in 1996, but it's just been re-released as a Picador classic. And it has an introduction by Steve Martin, the comedian, who's clearly a good friend of yours. You've had a long correspondence with him over the years, and he quotes some of that correspondence in the introduction. It's very personal.
Yeah, it is. So I take it from that that you think that I should be terrified of libel lawyers. It is. I asked him to write the introduction because we've had an email, present day email, previously fax, and prior to that letter writing correspondence ever since we worked together on LA Story in 1990. So he has volumes of my outpourings, if you like. So he obviously just chose to publish stuff in a broadsheet from the introduction. And I don't know how to answer that. Nobody seems to have taken umbrage, as far as I know. I've not been presented with any libel suit or anything.
I mean, he's clearly a good friend, and the fact that you reference faxes and things, this has gone on for a long time. So looking back at what you wrote back then, 20 years ago, would you have written the same book now, do you think?
It would be disingenuous to say that I am as terrified of being out of work as I was 20 years ago. And whether that's just age or accepting that, you know, how things have rolled out, I'm not sure. But that worry and having some money in the bank means that sort of ongoing, oh my God, am I ever going to work again, has certainly dissipated. So I couldn't write that. But I think the Jesuit thing of, you know, give me a boy when he is seven and I'll show you the man, absolutely remains that I don't think any wisdom has accrued upon me whatsoever. No, so it probably would be exactly the same.
He has a few telling lines in the book about you meeting with publishers, talking about writing it in the first place and how that was a pleasurable experience. And you say that it made you feel like you had some rat's fart's worth of control. And I wonder, that means it's a very different process or a very different experience then from acting.
Yeah, and what I meant by that is that this is the first time in my professional life where a whole group of people from different publishing companies were vying to offer me the best deal. And I'd never been in that situation before, because as an actor, you are tot for hire, and you're either called in or offered a job, or you're on a cattle call of people. So I can only imagine what maybe for some other actor walking in, he would be able to auction and decide who was going to be the best director for his Hamlet or her Hamlet, her Lady M or whatever. So it did feel like I had some rat's fart's worth of control at that moment in choosing which publisher was going to offer the most money.
And the whole process of writing, I mean, it had largely been done because it was a diary.
Yeah, so it was a complete doozy from my point of view, in that everything was written, and I then handed it in to had a brilliant editor called Georgia Garrett, who was working at Picador at the time, and she then swayed and sliced through it, all the repetition, and got rid of it. So hopefully it made me sound more articulate than I am in real life.
With Nail is obviously the role that we all associate you with, and it was the life-changing one for you. Did it feel that way at the time?
I knew when I read it, I thought whichever actor gets to play this part will be a career-changing moment for whoever got it, because every actor that you care to meet, maybe apart from Judi Dench, has been out of work for large swathes of time in their life. So all of the frustration and anger or bitterness that can develop in somebody or develops in actors over a time when the longer you're out of work, all of that is concentrated in the brilliant dialogue in that film, so, and the situations that they find themselves in. So I think that, honestly, any actor could have, whoever got that part, it was going to be significant in their lives. I'm just very grateful that it was me and not anybody else.
Getting that part, though, was a really long, protracted process, wasn't it?
Yeah, because the director-writer, Bruce Robinson, was very particularly, he'd never directed a film before, and it was entirely autobiographical, and he had a very clear vision and sound in his head of what the thing should look like and how it should be spoken. So he'd gone through 2 months worth of auditioning actors, and he said that nobody had said a single line that had either made him laugh or had sounded as he had imagined it in his head. And I said 2 words, "fork it," which gave him a glimmer of hope that he might be able to train me into the ways of righteousness to play this part. So it was really on those 2 words that the 2 week backwards and forwards audition process began 30 years ago.
Because, as you say, he wrote and directed the film and wanted every single word spoken to be one that he'd actually written. There's no improvisation here. And you quote him often in the book. He obviously has a very particular way of working.
He does. And I think that because he was a not very successful actor, but he understands what actors are like and that he is very, very disciplined about the fact that he said that if he spills his guts and spends hours and weeks and months writing something, he finds it very insulting when an actor comes along and maybe reads it once and goes, "Oh yeah, well, I'm going to say that, or I'm going to change this, or my character wouldn't do this or that." So it's much more like the respect that people have for a playwright in the theatre.
Mm.
Whereas in the movies, it is commonplace for umpteen writers to dibs in on a script or things to be changed on the day or to be improvised or changed by actors. And he was very, very determined that that shouldn't happen.
Mm. And how do you feel about your own words being changed in your own writing?
Oh, I don't have anything like that preciousness whatsoever. But then I'm not the writer that Bruce Robinson is, so that's the best way to answer that.
That film can be a very tedious business, and I wonder if that boredom was the impetus to start keeping a diary or if it was something you'd always done.
I'd always done it because ever since inadvertently witnessing my mother's adultery when I was 10 years old in the front of a car while I was supposedly asleep on the back seat of the car with my father's best friend, she was bonking, I couldn't tell anybody, and I tried God, got no answer. So I started keeping a diary from that age onwards. So it's been a lifelong habit since then.
Mm. Well, now that experience that you're describing, you put into your book Wawa Diaries, and of course that was all about the film that you made.
Yeah, and in that instance, because it was a 5-year process from writing the script to actually getting it into a cinema, which I know is probably normal for most films, but it was such a battle to do that I thought that even if the film never got made, I could at least get a book out of the film that never got made out of it. So I was very, very clear with everybody that I worked with right from the get-go that I was writing a book about the making of.
Mm.
So there was a tacit agreement that whatever happened, I was going to write about it.
Mm. So it must have been a very, very different experience from the other book, because it was always intended to be and not a kind of accidental diary, so to speak.
Yeah, except that I wasn't commissioned to write the book in those 5 years. When I completed the film, I then went to Picador again and said, "Would you be interested in publishing the diaries of this?" And they said yes.
It sounded, some of it, like quite an unhappy experience.
Yeah, it was brutal because I had a female French producer whose name I cannot even mention because I feel so vituperative about it. But what I realised very quickly was that it wasn't just personal to me. Her incompetence and her, I don't know whether she's a bald-faced liar or what.
She sounded insane in the book, actually.
Well,
completely off her head.
Yeah, but other people felt the same thing. And she has subsequently blotted a copybook on other films that she's tried to get made. So I know that as much as it was personal to me at the time, she did this to other people. But having said that, the film did get made in spite of her, and she was and still remains one of the named producers on the film. And she became inadvertently a great villainess in the story. Everybody who's read it has written into me or tweeted and said, my God, this person is, you know, we hate her so much. And so that's, I feel exonerated.
I'm feeling her career probably isn't going so well right now. Dealing with that kind of thing, I mean, a lot of people would be driven to drink or drugs. You famously don't drink.
No, I'm allergic to alcohol, though I come from a long line of alcoholics in my family. But I found out when I was 18 that I have no enzyme in bloodstream to process alcohol. So I literally can't keep it down. I think that it's like anything, that if I knew at the end how torturous the process was going to be, I probably never would have had the courage to go through with it. But it's incremental. It's only when you look back and you go, oh my God, you survived that, or you went through all of that. But on a day-to-day basis, in terms of this producer that we're talking about, I couldn't really imagine that she could have been as incompetent or pernicious as she actually was. And every time I get trumped because she'd come up with some other subterfuge that was just jaw-dropping, but makes for good copy.
Yeah, makes for very good copy, and it's a fabulous book.
Thank you.
You describe not only her, but there are some other places in which you might think that you could lose friends. Have you?
Not that I'm aware of. I think that it was never, you know, when I published the film diaries, I said to the editor, Georgia Garrett, at the time, and the libel lawyer that obviously has to go through anything that is telling the truth of something, that it was never my intention to write a slash fest or make myself unemployable, but just to be as candid and honest about the process of how films are made and cast and just the backstage business that goes on, that sometimes I think is much more Byzantine and intriguing than the actual film that gets put out. Mm. So with that in mind, they judiciously edited, nipped and tucked their way through it. But there's always the risk that as soon as you say something, if I said, you know, I just met Georgina today and she was wearing pearls and a black jacket and a cashmere cardigan, and then you go, well, it's not actually a cashmere cardigan, it's a gilet, it's a this or that, that people that you'd never expect to take umbrage about something can suddenly nitpick and say, well, actually, I wasn't wearing that on that day, which is what happened. I described somebody as having a red sweater and something, and they said, no, it wasn't, it was aubergine. And you just have to take a deep breath and go, okay, I'm sorry, it didn't get that colour right. But so, yeah, you never know. But
yeah.
As far as I know, I have not... I'm not being cut off of the knees for lack of friends as a result of publishing this stuff.
Well, speaking of friends, somebody you met quite a long time ago is in the news at the moment. Tell me about meeting Donald Trump.
He has hair like spun gold. And it was for a program called Hotel Secrets on Sky Atlantic, which was dealing with luxury hotels and the people involved with them and their histories in luxury hotels around the world, which was about the jammiest job that you could possibly
Absolutely.
Want to have, to stay in these extraordinary places. So I met him. He changed the meeting time about 7 times and then eventually demanded that it was 8:30 in the morning on, I don't know, the gazinthine floor of Trump Towers. So 3 years ago, before his apparent presidential campaign. And he also famously doesn't like to shake hands with people because he's germophobic. So I didn't offer my hand, and he said, why are you shaking my hand? And I said, well, I know that you're germophobic. And he said, oh, I'll shake your hand. And so I did, and he'd also prescribed that I had to have 10 questions that he had vetted in advance so that he knew exactly. And he said, okay, you got 10 minutes, sit down, go. So the first question I asked him, I said, you have a Scottish mother, a German father. I'm married to a Scots woman, so this Calvinist work ethic seems to be very strong in you, and in particular how you've brought your children up. He said, this is not one of the questions. And I said, well, you know, I'm not Michael Parkinson. I'm curious about how and who and what makes you Donald Trump. So he gave me a very beady eye for about 5 nanoseconds, and then he was off and running. And we couldn't stop him. I think he spoke nonstop for about 50 minutes. And against all my preconceptions and expectations, he had a sort of Barnum and Bailey-like showman, ringmaster, charm about him that was sort of unavoidable. But I was absolutely riveted as to see whether he'd had a hair transplant, a hair weave, cornrows, or whatever he had. But it just looked like sort of Elnett sprayed or heavily hairsprayed, which you could smell as soon as he came to the room, spun gold hairdo. And then I met his daughter, who had nothing but praise for him and runs his empire and was extraordinarily well disciplined. And he said he had two rules for his kids: no room service, because they grew up in hotels, and no alcohol, and no drugs, no alcohol or drugs. And so I told him that I didn't drink, and he said, "Well, you're doing good, kid, you're doing good." So it's a very long answer to your short question, what was like meeting Donald Trump. I think that he should be the president because he's going to wipe out terrorism. I say no more than that. What more could one ask for?
Now, the question you asked him, who and what makes him Donald Trump, yeah. Donald J. Trump, what makes Richard E. Grant? Because for a start, that's not your name.
No, I was born Richard Grant Esther Hazen. And when I went to drama school in Cape Town University in 1976, the drama professor said, "Your name has 11 letters in it, and it's too long and difficult to pronounce. What is your second name?" So I said, "Richard Grant." And he said, "Right, okay, that's what you're going to be known as if you succeed as a professional actor." So that's what happened. And when I came to London, I'd worked for about a year as Richard Grant. And then my name had appeared on a poster with Leonard Rossiter in Tartuffe at Bromley. And a man called Peter Grant, he was born Peter Grant, complained to Equity and said, "There's my name is on a poster, my name is Richard Grant." He turned out to be a retired character actor. So Equity said, "You've got to change your name." And I said, "I've got no money, I've printed my photographs and follow up. Please, can I speak to him directly and try and make some kind of compromise?" So they did, and I spoke to him, and he said he was born Peter Grant in 1931, and he had to change his name because there was a Peter Grant Fowler. And I said, "Could I put a name in between?" He said, "Yes." And then I thought, if he's on side already, I said, "Could I reduce it just to putting a letter in between?" He said, "Yeah, sure." So I phoned back the woman at Equity. It's a right old boiler. And she said, "Right, okay, what's it going to be?" And I said, R-A-G-R-R-B-G-R-D-G. She said, "I haven't got all day." I said, "R-E-G. She said, "Right, that's it." So that's how it got stuck. So Reg for short, really.
Does your gas bill come to Mr. Esterhazen?
No, it comes to Richard E. Grant.
Does it feel like a different person? Is Richard Esterhazen someone else?
Oh, the people that I grew up with, I still always remind them, or if I call them or text them, I say, "You know, this is Richard Esterhazen calling." But as I spent from 1976 till now, which is, I don't know how many years that is. Is that 40 years?
Something like that.
Yeah. As Richard Grant or Richard E. Grant, that is something that I'm more used to. So I'm always surprised if I hear the other.
Yes.
My actual name.
Richard E. Grant. We'll pause there and we'll come back in just a moment.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
You're listening to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin, and I'm joined in the studio today by actor and author Richard E. Grant. Do you think, and I think this comes across slightly in both books actually, that whenever it really gets over the feeling of, oh, I'm just a boy from Swaziland, or in my case, a girl from Zimbabwe, and here I am in the big wide world, the kind of imposter syndrome, I suppose.
Yeah, I still can't really, it sounds disingenuous, but I feel I'm still genuinely starstruck and still amazed by the people and what has happened in my professional life and personal life as well. And there's not a day that I get out of the tube at Piccadilly Circus and don't have this feeling that I had when I first came here when I was 7 years old and think, my God, I'm in London. This is the centre of the universe. So that doesn't go away. I now see that as a good thing because you don't, hopefully you don't get above yourself.
You seem to have this wonderful ability to kind of drink in everything around you. And I know through walking through Kew Gardens with you, it was almost impossible to take a single step without you breathing in all the fragrances around you. And in fact, you've gone on now to produce perfumes.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with smelling everything. So that is something that I've always done ever since I can remember. So it just has taken me a very long time to turn it into a professional product, because when I was 12, I had a mad crush on an American girl called Betsy Clapp in the year that they landed on the moon. And so all things American in Swaziland were just, you know, the bee's knees. So I couldn't afford to buy her perfume for her birthday. So I tried to make it out of gardenia and rose petals boiled in sugar water in jam jars and buried them in the garden for a couple of weeks. And of course, they just turned to stink bombs. And then I was on holiday in Mustique with the handbag accessories designer Anya Hindmarsh 3 years ago, and she saw me smelling everything inside and she said, are you going to do something about this? And so that triggered me to actually being taken seriously and starting trying to go into business. So I then did, as a one-man brand, self-financed, and launched Jack, a unisex fragrance, at Liberty 2 springs ago. And it was such an instant success that I then launched a second one, Jack Covent Garden, and I'm now doing Jack Piccadilly, which comes out this autumn.
And that whole process of putting a perfume together, I mean, how does that work?
Again, it's a bit like starting to make a film that you go in with the passion for it and the idea of what the perfume should smell like and what the list of ingredients will be. But then the business side of it and all that is akin to those wildebeest who cross the Mara River in a million migration. And as soon as you get to the water, there are just crocs ready to take a bite. And you just hope that you're going to have some skin on your bones and breath in your lungs by the time you get to the other side. Because once you start in business, on a daily basis, there are people out there who either tweet, email, Instagram, whatever, whichever which way they get to you, to try and take a nip of whatever you're trying to make money out of. And I understand that that's just the way that it is, but it's hilarious, some of the scams that people come up with. So you just have to, I suppose, like in the making of a film, you have to stick with the, hold on to the vision that you have in your head or the smell in your nose of what this thing should smell like. And I think that because it's so personal, your integrity is stamped all over it. And that is what customers seem to have responded to. And that's, I know, because we live in the media saturated age that we do, the advantage is that I get daily feedback via websites of what they think of the fragrances, which is great.
So smell, obviously a huge thing in your life. What about music? In Wawa, you talk about producing a CD for every character, the sort of music that they ought to or that they would have been listening to.
Yes, because I think that you can talk the hind leg off a donkey even more than I do. But if you play somebody a piece of music and you say, this is what I think this scene is about or what the emotional content of something is, it gives somebody an emotional response via music, which maybe words don't always convey in exactly the same way. Whereas if you play a piece of music, it's so powerful and evocative. And for every character I've ever played, I've always made up a top 10 list of the music that they would listen to and what scent or fragrance they would wear.
And can you listen while you're writing?
Whenever I write, I have music on. I have music on from dawn till dusk. It's a thing that I think more than anything keeps me sane. If other people have drugs or alcohol to alleviate the stresses of living, music is a thing that I feel bereft if I don't have access to it.
So going from this very kind of rich film world where you've got the music and you've got the people and the directors and the actors, writing must feel very solitary and perhaps quite one-dimensional.
In writing a diary, because it's something that I do, and now having an iPhone and iPad, I can just write, you know, going on the tube or the bus or whatever, to write things down, as opposed to having to wait till the end of the day. So that has been very liberating in a way. So that doesn't feel solitary in the same way. Writing, I'm sure every writer has always has said this, that because you're dealing with characters or people that you know or you're writing about, they are so vivid in your head that it doesn't feel as if you're on your own. The worst bit is just having to sit for so long. Writing a script or writing a novel, you just have to sit in that chair. Some people I know stand, Hemingway did, but I think just sitting down, you feel desk-bound, and that was the only bad side of it, I think.
Is there
and also the thing of having every excuse when you start in the morning of thinking, oh, well, I'll read the newspaper, I'll go online, I'll check my emails, I'll open the post, I'll walk around the house, I'll go for a run, whatever. You try and do anything to procrastinate the actual starting of it, but the moment you actually do sit down and start clacking away, it seems to come spooling out. So,
what's the next one?
I have no idea. No idea. I write stuff every day, but I've been writing lots of travel things, which is very seductive because two magazines asked me to go on a luxury safari to Tanzania, which I did. I came back 10 days ago, and then write about it. So that feels like about the easiest falling off a log situation, and somebody's paying you to go somewhere absolutely extraordinary and then to write about it. So I suppose that takes you away from any Tolstoyan intentions of writing the great big, you know, the big tome, which I'm certainly not doing.
But is there a plan for one?
No, because I'm too... I'm a very deeply superficial person, so no, I have no aspirations to do anything like that.
Thank you very much. The very, in his own words, superficial, Richard E. Grant.
Deeply superficial.
Thank you for coming on to Meet the Writers.
Thank you very much, Georgina.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Join us again to listen live at the same time next week, or subscribe to the SoundCloud channel for free and never miss an episode. Thanks to Claire Urban for production and to you for listening. I'm Georgina Godwin. Goodbye.